You know, when we talk about organization and support and what have you, we're very lucky tonight in having many figures in the Vancouver community and surrounding communities who are present with us today, who have contributed for decades to organize and build and inform. In particular, I'd like to note this evening the presence of Aziz Kaki and Mordechai Breinberg and Hanna Qawas and Barbara. And Barbara Rofker from Bellingham. Isn't it interesting? They represent all religions, all the monotheistic religions, as well as the non-religious. You know, after the war, many pondered, why Iraq? What is it about Iraq? A well-known journalist in the New York Times wrote and said, after 9/11, we wanted revenge. We wanted to teach those Arabs and the Muslims a lesson. Not teach Osama bin Laden. Not teach the criminals who participated in that crime or the organization that built it. But teach Muslims and Arabs a lesson. And how better to do that than to strike at the heart of the Arab and Islamic world. And Iraq is at the heart of the Arab-Islamic world. So that was the explanation he offered to his audience as to why the United States decided to invade Iraq. Of course, there are many other reasons. But this should provide you with an indication as to what goes on in the mind of the establishment as to the issue of Palestine. It's a tragedy we've been living with for the past century. It became especially damaging after 1948 and the rise of the Palestinian refugee problem. I spent 2 years of my graduate studies at the master's level studying modern Jewish thought. Several eminent Palestinian scholars guided me, Walid Khaldi, Hanna Batatu, some of the best minds in the Arab world. And I recall in my studies one individual, a British Jewish gentleman, who had developed the ideology of Zionism and later on developed the ITO, the Jewish Territorial Organization, by the name of Israel Moses Zangwill, wrote in the early 20th century and said, of all the countries of the world, when we look around, there is only one country where the Jew can find safety and live in brotherhood, and that is the Ottoman Empire. Ottoman Empire was Turkey and the Arab world. That being so at the beginning of the 20th century, why now is the situation the way it is? Nasir Aruri is a prominent Palestinian scholar. He is not just an academician. He's a humanist, an institution builder, a founder of organizations, an internationally recognized figure, who has made great contributions to his own people. He is the best illustration of that sharp national identity the Palestinian population has which will stay with them and will help them along the road in their suffering until the day comes when they have the right to return to their homes and to their land. Nasir Arouri, thank you.
Thank you, Henry, for this generous introduction. And thank you, Dr. Sonera, for that marvelous speech. It's a hard act to follow. With regard to that topic, I just would like to mention that we have an organization in Boston called the Trans-Arab Research Institute that both Dr. Faris and I work with it. We both serve on the board. This year, we commissioned a book titled Civil Rights in Peril, and it deals with the sort of things that Dr. Sonera talked about. In other words, it deals with the civil rights situation in the United States and the impact of September 11th on people who live there. So I just invite you to take a glance at the books, look at the table of contents, and so on. I would like to congratulate the Palestine Community Center on this first annual activity, and I would like to also thank my friends Dr. Hani Faris and Khalid and Reem Barakat for their tireless and consistent efforts to make this event a reality. I happen to have witnessed a portion of the work yesterday. I saw much of it, nitty-gritty, etc., and it is really a labor of love. Which also involved the contributions of numerous people. I would also like to express sincere gratitude from my wife, Joyce, and I to our gracious hostess, Jomana Faris, who made Vancouver a second home for us. I am also delighted to see that Al Awda and the Canadian Arab Federation, two of my favorite organizations, have co-sponsored this event. Greetings to both as well. Now let me talk about Iraq and Palestine in the context of a colonialist legacy. And just a few minutes ago, I decided to cut down my speech by, I don't know, something like 40% or so, because we began late, I think that considerably later than we had intended, logistics of dinner and so on. So I will not give my entire presentation, but hopefully we will have some exchange of ideas later on during the question and answer session. So I will begin with the Bush world's view and the aims of the war. I took it that Dr. Faris was inviting me to talk about that, about the why the war against Iraq. The invasion of Iraq was waged against the never demonstrated possibility that Iraq might someday strike with the non-existent and never proven weapons of mass destruction, either directly or through surrogates. Under the Bush doctrine, Iraq was a presumed threat to national security as terror comes closer to the gates of the now broadened sphere of what is known as the civilized world. That is a much more open-ended commitment than what had been assumed by Bill Clinton and Bush 1, despite the fact that both presidents have committed horrendous war crimes in bombing civilians in Iraq, Sudan, Afghanistan, Panama, and Siberia, among others. The Bush 2 doctrine entails a commitment that keeps the U.S. in a permanent state of military readiness and a willingness to go after evildoers long before they strike. This is the new national security doctrine for the 21st century. The Bush doctrine, where military action is not intended to avert an imminent threat. That would be called preventive war. I mean, that would be called preemptive war. But this is really preventive war because there is no real evidence that there is an imminent threat. This is something that I've been referring to not just as the Bush doctrine, but really as the Bush Sharon doctrine. After all, Sharon has been the mentor. You know, on the sixth visit, Sharon made 9 visits to Washington, I think all in all so far. On the sixth visit, I remember Bush, too, was saying that he is my teacher. Every time he comes, I learn something from him. Now, recently, some of you, I think, read that statement, that interview by Brent Scowcroft, who was advisor to Bush's father, told him about the world situation and how to conduct things. Well, Scowcroft said that Bush had, that Sharon had Bush wrapped around his finger, and he said that he kept him mesmerized. You read that, I think. If you haven't, I recommend you take a look at it. So we have now a national security doctrine for the 21st century, and that's really the Bush doctrine of preventive war. So when we look at containment of the 60s, 70s, 80s, etc., and deterrence, these belong to a bygone era. The world of the neoconservatives and their Likudist allies is a Hobbesian world, where the landscape is rough and evil all around, calling for a strong hand. Thus, you do not wait for evil doers to attack. You attack first preventively. There is no need for proof beyond reasonable doubt. These are the terms that were actually used by Wolfowitz. He said this is not a judicial process. So there's no need, really, for proof beyond reasonable doubt. The emphasis, he said, must be on intentions and capability. And we know that Saddam had the intentions. You know, we have celestial connections. We have a way to know his mind. So the intentions and the capability. Well, they had a problem with capability, actually. Now, for the battered Iraqi citizens who bore the major brunt of the savage bombing, this doctrine of Bush II leaves no doubt where the real boundaries lie between the excess of evil and the excess of civilization. There is a link between Fallujah and Gaza, which will continue to haunt millions of Arabs and Muslims for decades to come. It is already seen as a Western crusade against Muslims, Arabs, and Islam. Why this war against Iraq? Well, the broader agenda of this war includes remapping, includes reshaping the strategic landscape in the Middle East and Central Asia, which has been viewed since World War II, I mean the area of the Middle East and Central Asia, it has been viewed as the stupendous source of strategic power. This is military strategic language. Since the end of the Second World War, military planners in the U.S. have been referring to it as a stupendous source of strategic power. So the phrase stupendous, etc., came to convey in the American strategic lexicon that the world's major energy resources in this region must be dominated by the U.S. as the new imperial power. That's axiom number one. This has got to be dominated by the United States, and anything that stands in the way just has to be removed. And so the area must be kept in a state of dependency, free of opposition, and fully compliant with America's hegemonial designs, ironically, in the names of reform, in the name of democracy, and fighting terror. Now, the war has global imperatives, global dimensions, and it also has regional imperatives and dimensions. Let's look at the global. Just quickly summarize them, since I'm going to do some summarizing tonight. At the global level, the Bush administration seems to have rendered the United Nations inoperable, having effectively reduced the permanent members of the Security Council to 1, basically. There is also an EU dimension I mean, going to Iraq was intended also to send a message to the European Union that those of you who aspire for autonomy in the world system better forget that, because there's not going to be any autonomy. And that message was clearly directed to France, Germany, Russia, and so on. No more autonomy will be allowed. Also, as you probably know, the dollar would be defended against the euro, and Iraq's dealing with the latter would be nipped in the bud before it penetrated OPEC. Thus, this was a war beyond regime change. It was a war beyond weapons of mass destruction. It was a war, indeed, beyond the Middle East. The ultimate aim of the neoconservatives who masterminded that war is unquestioned U.S. supremacy in a new unipolar world, a policy recently described again by Brent Scowcroft as a failing venture just a couple of weeks ago. Now, at the regional level, with regard to why the U.S. went to war, the strategy of the neoconservatives, as I understand it, I think aims to reshape the geopolitical order in such a way as to weaken all parties that are deemed anti-Western, anti-imperialist, and promote those countries and regions which operate as pillars or gendarmes of U.S. imperialism. Take the country of Syria. I mean, I thought that, and many other people really thought that Syria was one of the countries that would fit in the category of those who surrendered, or surrendered somewhat, because I think that the U.S. has been, you know, during the Clinton period, Bush 1, Clinton, and now Bush 2, has been trying to somehow subordinate a lot of third world countries and ensure that this can be done without invasion, that it can be done through the tool of the World Bank and in the International Monetary Fund. This would be the more civilized way of doing it, you know, according to these people. That's why they love Clinton. So he didn't use an invasion, although he bombed, I think, a lot of people. Didn't invade, but he did a lot of bombing. So I was saying that Syria, we thought that Syria was one of the countries that have made concessions, but apparently not to the satisfaction of the neoconservatives in Washington, because the passage of the Syria Accountability Act in December 2003, which was followed, by the way, as you know, by the UN Security Council resolution, the famous 1559, just last month, which lays down a list of demands on Syria. It was intended to intimidate Syria, to bring it to manageable proportions through forced compliance. In other words, whatever reservations Syria has to be gone completely. You must surrender on our terms, but not on the terms that you find acceptable. There's Iran also. The threats against Iran and the targeting of its nuclear policies are intended to manipulate the domestic balance in Iran, not to rule out the eventual dismantling of the Islamic Revolution outright, Iraqi style.